So welcome everyone to our seventh shiur. This one's titled Ovarian Transplants and Oncom Fertility in Jewish Law. This is the Stephen Prower Jewish Medical Ethics Memorial Series, and tonight's learning is the Zecha Nishmas Chaim Shmuel Meir ben Abba Halevi. So tonight we actually have a very interesting topic, something that is, usually I try to come up with a cute name, but because of this, the nature of the topic, I decided maybe that wasn't the best idea. All right, so as usual, we'll start with our cases. So the two cases that I'd like us to keep in mind throughout the lecture, the first one is a case of Chaya. Chaya, when she was 11 years old, she was diagnosed with leukemia, and she was treated with high-dose chemotherapy. The cancer has been cured, but the treatment damaged her ovaries, resulting in early menopause. So her ovaries aren't working as well, and now she is infertile. And Chaya is now 30 years old. She's married, and she wants to have kids, so she's awaiting an ovarian transplant to restore her ovarian function and fertility. And we'll see if that's possible, how that works, and all the halachic issues. The second case, which we'll deal with towards the end of the lecture, is Shimon. Shimon's 14. He was just diagnosed with cancers, and the doctor wants to start his treatment right away. However, Shimon's worried because he heard this treatment will render him infertile. So he wants to know, can he bank his sperm? Can he, for later use when he gets married? So let's begin. So this idea of ovarian transplants, although it sounds something kind of futuristic, at least in my mind, is actually something that first occurred in the 19th century. The end of the 19th century was the first time they did the first recorded ovarian transplant, somewhere in the 1890s. And essentially, physicians were, unfortunately, none of the ones they did in the 1890s were actually sick, gave forth a live child. However, one doctor, Robert T. Morris, as you can see here in the medical record, so he was a lucky man. And essentially, in 1902, he did an oophorectomy, meaning he removed the ovaries of this woman, and he placed a small portion of ovaries from another woman into his patient. 4 years later, he made medical history by his patient delivering the first live birth after an ovarian transplant. So that's the first case of ovarian transplant. Now, there was discussion back then. They were curious how that worked or did it work. There was a lot of bioethical discussion of who should the mother be. Interestingly enough, the secular people came up with their same ideas as the Jews. maybe once we've taken it out of the mother, so it's not part of it. And what we'll see in a little bit is what they actually understood, you know, at that time. So let's talk a little bit about the halachic response. So it's important, like I just said, to whenever... The halachic response that happened around this time kind of forms our current view of what we think should be the halacha by ovarian transplants. So it's really essential for us to understand what was the medical understanding at the time. What did the rabbanim who are answering these questions, what did they think actually happened? And what did they think actually happens normally during, what do they think the ovaries do? What do they know about reproductive physiology? And Dr. Reichman has a phenomenal article in Tradition on this where he really goes through this and has a great analysis. So, and I'll summarize some of what he said. So the first halachic discussion came in this European journal, in the Hungarian journal, I'm sorry, called Vialeket Yosef. This is a Hungarian journal, and Rabbi Yaakov Gordon in 1907, so it took about a year or so before the Jews found out about this and started writing about it, which makes sense. You know, they didn't have easy access to PubMed, exactly, let alone, you know, journals everywhere. So he posed an open question, and I brought it, you know, here to look at because of the language he uses. And if you skip down to the underlined part, his question is, he's heard about these doctors, lehoshiv klei leida me'isha. So he uses the terminology klei leida. Now, when I first read that, klei leida, what would klei leida mean to you? Right. That's what I thought. I would have thought that was a uterus. What do you think? Yeah, I don't know. It's a little bit of ambiguous. And he goes on, he asks, he says, you know, he heard this, oh, so I'm allowed to do it. Can a mother give to her daughter? Who would be the mother? And these further questions. So over the next couple
is that
of...
a halachic term?
Klei leida?
Yeah, is that term ever used before?
I don't know. I've never heard it either. Okay. That doesn't mean... I don't know that much.
I'm just curious, like, if he was borrowing that from somewhere else.
I think that it might have been because he wasn't entirely sure of what it was, and we'll see that in a little bit. because of his ambiguous questions. So over the, so this journal over the next couple of years, different rabbis, you know, attempted to answer his question, and it's really interesting to see because they all had very different understandings of what actually had happened. In fact, one Rabbi Deitch, he actually thought what had happened was that they had actually transplanted the ovaries, the uterus, and the external genitalia. So therefore, in his discussion, he discusses whether there's an Isser Erva, because you're touching another woman's genitalia. And he ultimately says it's not a problem because it's been transplanted. But the point is that it's really fascinating that the various different beliefs. And that's why it's important for us to take a look and see what exactly they thought was going on. So Rabbi Kamelhar, a few years later, in HaTalmud Umadi HaTevel, so he talks about this Chicago Medical Convention. This is in 1910, 1911, around that time. So this is already, you know, six years later. And he said he heard it, that the doctors were talking about an ovarian transplant. So now we actually, he was curious what would be the halacha. And it doesn't seem that he actually had seen any of this other stuff. But he comes up with a very novel approach. And what's interesting, Dr. Rechem points out that he seemed to think that the ovary stimulates natural fertility without providing any material contribution. So he felt that the ovary isn't necessarily contributing much to the, you know, because they didn't know about genetics back then. Genetics wasn't something. They might have known that there were eggs, but they didn't necessarily know what the eggs did. You know, they knew eggs existed, and we had to inseminate, but they didn't necessarily know, the material contribution that was there. And therefore, he has a very interesting shot, and it's found here in the Yoredeya in Hilchos Behemah V'Chaya Tahura Simen Pei Dalet. And he discusses this concept of birds that grow on trees. So the creature originates from the seed of a bird, but the ikar comes from the tree eggs. And therefore, he said it was an insect, instead of it being a bird, even though the seed originated from the bird. But since he wanted to say that, therefore, this is a proof that the ovarian recipient, whose role he believed predominates the process of conception, because he didn't think the ovaries really did that much, is the halachic mother. And therefore, he held the donor has no maternal rights to this child, because he didn't think that the ovary really did much. So following this, there's a famous Shut Evan Yekara. And now why is this famous? It's famous because the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, uses this and quotes this many times in his Tshuvos when discussing these things. And he talks about, he uses the word, if you look at the underlined, first underlined line, he says, HaTachbula asher himtziu harofim lachtoch klei haholada. So I thought this was probably referring to, I didn't necessarily think it was referring to ovaries, but it's the klei haholada. And they attach them to this other woman, and then she's suddenly able to have a child. And he actually says, you know, the question is who would be the mother of the child? He says, interestingly enough, on the third line, ki ani rachok libi lahamin lekol hashmua hazos. I don't really believe this. But he says, let's just say for argument's sake that this actually could happen. What would be the halacha? And so then if you skip down to the second from the last line, the underline, Avladhu ben Shalasheni. He says it's the second, it's the recipient, the kol davar. And what's the makor? His makor is the Gemara in Sota, which is on your left. What's the Gemara in Sota? Yelda shesibcha bezikena, right? We've seen this in previous shurim. So if I have, if I take a sapling, right, saplings, we're not allowed to, you have to wait 3 or 4 years before you can eat from its fruit. And if I took a branch of a sapling and I grafted it onto an older tree, which I could eat its fruit, and that tree now bore fruit, so the Gemara says that's considered, you don't have to wait for Arla. And it's this concept of batla yodel zakena, which we'll see over and over again. So therefore, the Evan Yekara, Rabbi Yamin Weiss, felt that that this would apply, that this should apply by the ovarian transplant. Dr. Reichman has a whole discussion here, and he says that he felt it's unclear exactly what Rabbi Weiss understood actually happened, and what he actually understood of reproductive physiology, and therefore he actually he just says it's important to kind of put those framing remarks when reading the Tshuvos. The next source came from something called Habe'er. Habe'er was an Eastern European journal, and this is in the 1930s. So a rabbi by the name of Chaim Zev Wolf Weinreb. Now, the question is, what happened in the 30s that suddenly they started talking about ovarian transplants again? And Dr. Eichmann, who is an expert in medical history, said he doesn't know. So I don't either. But he seemed to have a much better understanding of exactly what happened. And he understood that the ovaries gave forth the eggs. And therefore, he said it's very hard for him to understand why Rabbi Kamelhar felt that there was absolutely no connection. And he seemed to think that both the donor and the recipient have some right to the child. He also discusses the interesting question of serous. So am I allowed to remove ovaries? Because castration, right? Normally we're not allowed to castrate ourselves. And he discusses that maybe if the ovaries are non-functional, that wouldn't be a problem. And he discusses how you know if it's non-functional. And he said maybe you don't know if it's non-functional for sure, and therefore you shouldn't take it out. But he leaves that. If you're interested more in the serious issue, definitely you can look at it there. So this takes us to the modern-day poskim. So what do the modern-day poskim hold on this issue? And it's a very interesting issue. And everyone I spoke to was like, that's a hard one. But so let's see a little bit of what's written and then what I orally spoke to a different rabbanim about. So the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg. So you see here in the middle of your page, so it's a long tshuva. He quotes his Evan Yekara in many different places, but this one is one of the tshuvas in that he quotes many different Evan Yekara. He quotes the Kolbo, which I didn't show you. And interestingly, he quotes Rabbi Eliezer Deitch, which, again, is interesting since we know that he had a very wild understanding of what actually happened. But, one could argue that maybe that doesn't actually make a difference. Nevertheless, Rabbi Waldenberg feels it would be the concept of batla yodel is a kena, in which case it would be the ovarian recipient who would be the mother. Now, in previous shiurim, we've discussed the concept of egg donation and who's the mother at length. And if you remember from our last shiur, we discussed that conceiving the egg inside the woman might be one of the determinants, that the woman conceiving inside of her. But with an egg donation, that was not possible, because usually with egg donation, the conception occurs outside the woman. So the question that I was curious as I went into this is, so we know what the answer would be. According to those who held egg donations, birth mother is the mother, then this is not a problem. The question is, with an ovarian transplant, would I maybe, even those who said it was the genetic mother, would things change? The fact that the conception occurred inside the woman, would that make a difference? And taking it one step further, the fact that the eggs matured inside of me, and the woman, not me, but the woman, and the woman ovulated these eggs, does that make a difference? So Rabbi Michael J. Broyd, in his book, Marriage, Sex, and Family in Judaism, so he says that he feels the one who ovulated, conceived, cultured, and bore this child is the halachic mother. Rabbi J.D. Bleich, I spoke to him today, and so I asked him if he could explain to me his position. So he said that by egg donation, he feels that the leda, right, the birth, is the determinant. However, he says, we also have to be choshish for the zera ha'isha, the fact that the woman does contribute something, we have to be concerned for. So therefore, he felt by egg donation, it should be both. He says, however, he feels by ovarian donation that he would say batel yodel zakena, and it would be solely the birth mother. It sounds like it's because it's grafted on. It's literally what the Gemara was saying. You're actually grafted, and I can see a difference between egg donation, where it's really I'm placing an egg inside you, versus an ovarian transplant, where I'm actually sewing the ovary into you. And so he said he doesn't feel it has anything to do with the conception or where the ovulation occurred. It simply has to do with the fact that he would apply batel yodel zakena. So what about those who held it was genetics? Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who we've mentioned in the past, he holds that the genetics is the determinant by egg donation. Would he still feel that way here? So I spoke to him today, and he said, yes, even by an ovarian transplant, he would feel that even though it's grafted on, he still feels you follow the genetics. And we'll see what he says regarding the ovarian stem cells later on. Okay. So now, while ovarian transplants hailed a treatment for infertility, and this was something that was very exciting, however, it soon became overcome by IVF. Where once we started being able to do in vitro fertilization, that became a much simpler, better, easier way to treat infertility. However, recently, this topic has garnered significant interest as a method to treat other issues stemming from oncofertility. And this leads us to really the next part of our discussion, the ovarian transplants in the 21st century. So what's currently going on? So we've talked about what's happened in the past, the medical aspect. We've talked about the halachic discussion in the past and the halachic discussion today. But scientifically, reality, are we actually doing this? What is it? What exactly is an ovarian transplant? Why would someone want to do it? And how do we do it? And then, most importantly, does it work? All right, we can talk about it all we want, but does it actually work? So let's start with what is it? So there's two different ways we can do it. So we can transplant a whole ovary, right? We can actually cut out an ovary from one woman and place the whole ovary into the woman. Or we can do with something, ovarian tissue. So we can take strips or pieces of the ovarian tissue from one woman, which contains significant, each little piece contains a lot of eggs, and we can put that piece into the other woman. Ah, great question. We're going to get to that. Where do we put it? If you look on the next page, you'll see there's many different places to put it. We'll discuss that. So what are the two different, there's two types, general types of ovarian transplants. One's called a heterotransplant, in which we actually take, we get ovarian cells from another woman. And one's called an autotransplant, in which we take cells from the woman, and then we save them, we preserve them, and then we'll put them back into the woman later. So we'll start with heterotransplant. So heterotransplant, because autotransplant doesn't seem to have too many halachic issues. Heterotransplant is our who's the mother question. So why do we do a heterotransplant? So different reasons we do it is essentially, one, like our case that we said, exposure to chemo or radiation. So someone had, her ovaries were destroyed, unfortunately, by the chemo or radiation therapy. She might have had ovarian cancer, and we had to actually take out her ovaries. She might have premature ovarian failure, which we'll see a case of in a minute. Another paper I saw talked about very different treatments for autoimmune disorders that can affect fertility. And this is now a way to help regain her fertility. So, okay, great. So we've talked about different reasons why you would do it, but do we actually do this? You know, heterotransplant, that's serious stuff. You know, transplant surgery is not simple. So the answer is yes, and if you look here on page 2, the New England Journal of Medicine over here, so this case is talking about between twins. In 2007, there was monozygotic 24-year-old twins, and one had premature ovarian failure and the other one didn't. And so her sister was trying to get pregnant, she tried egg donation, tried a whole bunch of things, none of it worked. So finally they decided to do a little mini laparotomy, and they placed some little ovarian tissue from one, placed in the other, and lo and behold, her sister gave birth to a healthy-appearing baby girl. So what would halacha say, right? Would halacha say that, so we just saw, basically, that there's a machlokas, as with most things in Jewish law. And it would seem that, I would say there's maybe more here who would say that it's the birth mother than by egg donation. But nevertheless, we still would have that machlokas. So that's heterotransplant. How about autotransplant? Autotransplant is this idea that I'm going to save some of my own tissue. So while there isn't really a lot of halachic issues here, it's just an interesting thing. This is basically this idea of preserving ovarian tissue cryopreservation. So we're trying to preserve the fertility. So this is a process that's been really improving over the last 15 to 20 years and hasn't really been used because, as we'll see, but is now slowly being used. So why would someone do an autotransplant? So one option is that, let's say, you can't retrieve eggs, because we'll talk in a minute that we can actually preserve eggs, but for this woman, couldn't preserve the eggs, right? We couldn't stimulate her with hormones because either there wasn't enough time, or maybe her cancer, whatever she had, is sensitive to hormones, so you don't want to give more hormones. That would be a bad idea. Or you have, Rahman al-Hassan, you have a 10-year-old girl. So if you're a 10-year-old girl, there's no way to retrieve eggs, right? She's prepubescent. She hasn't hit puberty yet. So the only option to spare her eggs would really be to take out a piece of the ovarian tissue and to save that. So does this work? It's a great idea, right?
Can you induce puberty?
Huh?
Can you induce puberty?
You should be able to with hormones, but that's not necessarily something we want to do. Yeah, I mean, you should be able to give hormones. We can do pretty much anything these days. You should be able to induce hormones, puberty with hormones. So does this work? Does this, I mean, it sounds wonderful, you know, I'll take out a piece of your ovaries and I will save it, but does this actually work? And so for that, turn to the next page of your handout. And you see this really cool case from, it actually occurred in Tel Aviv in 2005. And this was a 28-year-old woman who had, the doctors froze her ovarian tissue, and she had had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. 2 years later, she was infertile. So what did they do? So if you take a look at the picture on your right, you see exactly what they did. So they took strips of her ovaries, and they placed it in her, and they actually surgically placed it into her left ovary. And they took pieces, you know, fragments, and injected it into the right ovary. Within 9 months, she started having periods, and a single egg was retrieved. So this had, so it had to be done through IVF, but she was able to get one egg, and which resulted in a pregnancy, in a live birth. Now, that was with IVF. Even more recently, last year, there's a story out of Denmark in which this woman who had an ovarian transplant, first she had to do IVF, but her second child she actually gave birth naturally. And doctors in Denmark were hailing that as a medical first. So we're moving along. So this actually does work. Now, do they always put it in the ovaries, right? Our question is, where do they put it? So this is really cool. So there's a little diagram here that I found. That's all the different places that we could possibly put it, or that we currently put it. Now, the coolest one is the article that's adjacent to this picture, and I'll read it. It sounds a little like science fiction, but researchers in the Netherlands report they were able to preserve fertility in a 29-year-old cervical cancer patient by removing her ovary to treatment and placing it inside her upper arm. Now, why would they do that? Well, they did that because presumably that's an easy way to retrieve the eggs, right? Why do you have to go transvaginally and pull it up? No, just right here, right there. They were able to, so... Cool. But the other ways we do it, they can put it actually in the same place where the ovaries were. They'll put it sometimes in what they call a peritoneal pocket. They can put it in the abdominal walls. They can try to anastomose it with the veins, some, you know, or they don't have to do it. So there's a lot of different ways that they can do it. Now, one of the only reservations or the safety concerns with this really has to do with if you have someone you're treating for cancer, right, you don't really want to take the cancer out and then put it back in later on. So therefore, they usually don't do this unless it's pretty certain that there are not going to be malignant cells there. So cancers like leukemias, they generally don't, and blood-borne cancers, they generally don't do this. Okay, so this moves on to what we had just mentioned briefly, this concept of egg preservation or oocyte cryopreservation and sperm banking. So oocyte preservation, it was something that could not be done until recently. It's really cool. Until recently, we were only able to freeze embryos. Now, the problem with embryos is that embryos require sperm. So you need to have someone who you would like to have a child with in order to preserve your embryos. Now, why were they unable to freeze these eggs, right? We had the eggs. We were able to get them. So one of the reasons why is they're one of the largest cells in the body, and they have a lot of water in it. So when you freeze these things, so much like, think about your bagel, right? When your bagel stays in the freezer too long, what happens? It forms all those ice crystals on it. So that's what was happening inside this ovarian cell, this egg cell. This egg was getting ice crystals in the inside, and as you can imagine, that probably doesn't do well for the safety or life of that cell. So while the embryos was this embryo freezing was working, it was for young people or those without partners, they were really out of luck. So we really needed a better way, a better method to preserve. And what's interesting is that a lot of this research came out of Italy, because in Italy, which is bound by a lot of Catholic law, they couldn't cryopreserve embryos. So since they couldn't cryopreserve embryos, the only option they had was to try to cryopreserve the eggs. So they did actually a lot of this research. And the first pregnancy from a vitrified oocyte, so they've actually gone through different methods of trying to freeze it, but the first pregnancy from a frozen egg occurred in 1999, and lots of research has really brought this along. So lastly, is this safe? Does it work? Is this something that we can actually do? So this is a study that I found, it's actually from January of this year, in Best Practices in Research, Clinical Obstetrics and Gynecology. And it talks about the recent advances in the oocyte and ovarian tissue cryopreservation. And there they quote a bunch of different studies, which shows that the pregnancies in the infants that are conceived after the cryopreservation do not present an increased risk of adverse effects, congenital anomalies, and in fact they report that over 1,000 children have been born through frozen and thawed oocytes. which is pretty cool. However, they say that this is still an experimental method. Now, conceivably, right, we've talked about this idea of doing this so far mainly for purposes of trying to preserve your ovarian, your eggs, before you undergo a procedure. What about a 22-year-old woman who says, you know what, I don't know, I want to do a lot of stuff before I get married, but I know I want my eggs to be younger. It's always better to have younger eggs, so why don't I just freeze a bunch of eggs now, and this way I can have children at age 40, age 50, whatever, later on in my life. So, I actually don't know, but maybe I'll have to Google it and find out. But this is not something I have an answer for you to. Would halacha allow such a thing that I'll call preemptive fertility preservation? I don't know. But that's just something to throw out there as an interesting question. So this leads us to our second to last thing. And this is the sperm banking. So, right, going back to our case two. Right? So we actually spoke a little bit about artificial insemination by a husband, right? We had a shiur on paternity earlier on. And the same discussion basically occurs here. Because by the AIH, the question is, what's the issue with artificial insemination that you have to actually get the sperm out of the man? So, and there's concern that expressing the sperm causes hashchasa zera, destruction of the sperm. As we said there, that most poskim felt that it was not a problem to do this because the emission of the semen was for procreational purposes. Now, taking our second case, does this change if the man's not married? So right here we have our 14-year-old kid, Shimon. He's not married. So would we still say that's for procreational purposes? So what would you think?
Still the chiyuv.
Okay.
Yeah, the chiyuv of peruvu, I think, is regardless of whether you're married or not. Just getting married is the halachically acceptable
way to fulfill that. Okay. What do you guys think? All right. Okay. So let's see. So Rabbi Bekashi Daron. Let's see what it comes out to. So here on the right, you'll see I brought down the Nishmas Avram. So Rabbi Bekashi Daron, he's an Asya, but he's also quoted in the Nishmas Avram in Yoredeya 23:3. So Rabbi Daron, about halfway down, you'll see the word Bazra Melechtit in parentheses, and he says that he asks this question to Rabbi Yashiv. What's the question? The question was that he had a bachur who was engaged, but he's not married yet, who needed to undergo a treatment, and he wanted to know if he could bank his sperm. So what did Rabbi Yashiv answer? So if you skip down one, two, three lines, four, five, okay, sorry, three quarters of the way down. He says, Hitzia hagoner of Rabbi Yashiv. Yashiv is the first word on the line. He says, I'm sorry, but I don't think it's permitted. Ein lahatir. And Rav Bekashi Daron took to this to mean, Kevan sha'abachar adayin lo nasa isha, since he hasn't married yet, eino chayev b'poel b'mitzvah's peri of Rivia. He's not chayev in the action of the mitzvah of peruvu, and therefore, this would not be considered for procreational purposes, even though this is a case of a person who's engaged. And actually, he discusses, if you look in Asya, he says he tried to get the couple to get married sooner, but it wasn't able to, for whatever reason. The woman cycle wasn't at the right time, so he wasn't able to just get married. Have no fear, because if we read on, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach will agree with you, David. And he says, but he asked, anyways, so Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, Ein kol hevdel bein ish nasui ubein ravik. So he says, there's no difference. And however, you know, he goes on to say that Ein lasos davar zan, the second to last line of the paragraph, ki lo kachashkafasal shal Torah. He says, yes, it's okay, but maybe we should do it. It doesn't seem to be within the Hashkafos HaTorah. But he says, you know, there's no difference between the chiyuv between a man and a married or unmarried man. So Rabbi Bleich, in Tradition in 1995, one of the few articles in English, so he discusses this as well. And he actually makes an interesting point. He basically says he agrees with Rosh Shlomo Zalman, and he felt that the consensus of halachic opinion is that there is no difference between married and unmarried men regarding sperm banking. But, and I'm going to quote from him because of his eloquence, at the same time, such procedures are discretionary at best and certainly not mandatory. He felt that Rosh Shlomo Zalman and Rav Yashiv discourage but don't prohibit the procedure, and he says this is based upon well-grounded hesitation to sanction halachically controversial methods of semen procurement for a purpose that is discretionary in nature. Essentially, since it's not something that you're mechayev to do and it's something that you can only do, it's discretionary, he didn't feel that we should necessarily sanction these not dubious, but controversial methods. However, it seems that Rabbi Bleich would allow a person to use sperm banking based on what he's written here. So this leads us to the next page in your handout and a very exciting last 5 minutes. So this is really the cutting edge. This is the new frontiers of ovarian stem cells, right? So this past Sunday, an article came out in Nature Medicine called Oocyte Formation by Mitotically Active Germ Cells Purified from Ovaries of Reproductive Age Women. Essentially what that means is that, and I also have here the New York Times article that discusses this. It's a good article if anyone wants to read it. But essentially what happened was is that scientists have found that they can use stem cells in the ovaries to generate eggs. So researchers at Mass General in Boston and in Japan have discovered something that goes against what's been current medical knowledge for the last 60 years. Right? We always thought that a woman is born with all the eggs she will have. But however, the researchers have isolated stem cells from the human ovary, and they've generated immature eggs, egg cells in the lab. They were then able to go on and have these stem cells create follicles with eggs that even had the correct amount of DNA. And they said they can even retrieve these stem cells from frozen tissue as well. Now, while they point out that this technology is not ready for general use, they did a lot of this study in mouse models using human ovarian tissue in the mouse. They were able to create human ovarian cells, which ovarian eggs, which also would be an interesting question if we could borrow mice ovaries to make our eggs, but what would be the halachic status of that? But we're not going to go into that here. Although Dr. Eichmann does like to talk about that in some of his lectures, but he usually talks about because this didn't exist. He usually talks about using the uterus of a cow as a gestational host. Anyways, but so what do you think the halacha would be in this case? Who would, if I took these stem cells from one woman and I stuck the stem cells into this other woman? And inside that woman, what happens, right? Inside the recipient. So these stem cells create follicles. They create the eggs. They ovulate the eggs. So they're actually creating the eggs, as opposed to an ovarian transplant that kind of just puts the eggs in there, and then the eggs ovulate, mature and ovulate. This, I'm inserting even a step earlier. I'm putting something that now has that now can create the eggs. So what would halacha say in this? So I would have thought, so obviously, like we said, regarding the birth, those who held it was the birth mother, this isn't really a question. The question is really, if you hold it, the genetics, what would be the halacha in that case? So I asked Rabbi Bleich, and Rabbi Bleich told me that he would probably still say it is the genetic, that it would be the birth mother. He also was discussing with me that it also might depend on the size of the stem cell. He wanted to know, can you see the stem cell with your naked eye? I'm not sure how that would change it, though. I didn't get to press him on that. I mean, I know there's a whole discussion about whether halacha works with the microscopic things that you can't see. So I'm not sure what he was getting at there. But so I asked Rav Willig. I figured, maybe I can convince a geneticist to move over to the other camp. And he said, nope. He would still follow the genetics. And I said, even though, it's like the whole, everything is coming from, all you're using is just, you have a stem cell, and then you're creating everything from there. And he still felt it would follow the genetics. So that's our cutting edge issue. That's the exciting, I was lucky that my shear fell out in the same week, so that I could actually talk a little bit about it. Any questions? That is a great question. Does adoption fulfill the mitzvah of having children? So, interestingly enough, adoption doesn't, the way adoption occurs in American law doesn't exist in Jewish law, right? In American law, when you adopt someone, you become b'no l'chol davar, right? You inherit, let's say you have an adopted child, properly adopted, they would inherit with the other kids, they have the same rights as all the other kids. So in halacha, we don't really have adoption. We do have concepts that, right, the Gemara says that a person who, that if you're a megadol, someone in your house, it's considered as if they're yours. So halachically, we do have this concept that raising children, that they are considered your child, but it wouldn't be in the legal sense of Yerusha. There are discussions also regarding avelos. A lot of rabbanim would say that yes, one should, while they might not be absolutely required to, but they should accept upon themselves avelos. So there is a lot of discussion in that area, but it doesn't necessarily work in the same legal method that American adoption works. Any other questions? All right, great. Thanks for coming. Did this time work for everyone?